James Caruso, we are doing yet another episode here of Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific, and we just went over 40,000 views on YouTube.
It must be you.
it's my charm and good looks. Jim, who do we have joining us today?
Well, you know, we've been remiss. We'd say we're interested in Indo-Pacific, but so far we haven't done a single episode about the largest entity by population of the region, a country growing at better than 7% GDP, a country who has a lot of chief executives from their country, chief executives here with our high-tech firms. And we have Ambassador Atul Keshav, an old colleague of mine, who was ambassador to Sri Lanka, chargé d'affaires in India, spent a lot of his long, distinguished career at the State Department dealing with the subcontinent. Atul, welcome. So good to see you again. And so we're going to ask you our first question, which we always start is, why should Americans care that India, which we've always, as kids, you know, starving people in India, why should we care that they may become the third largest economy in the world?
Well, Jim and Ray, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. Jim, I really cherish our times together in government service. You were a wonderful chargé d'affaires in Australia, leading our bilateral relations with one of our greatest friends in the world and a Quad partner. And it's great to see you again. And Ray, thank you very much for organizing all of this. So friends, I guess from my perspective, you have to look at the world as it is right now, which is for Americans, a scene of increasing geostrategic turbulence where you've got the Russians and the Chinese, the Iranians and the North Koreans, basically, you know, kind of getting together in a coalition that does not mean to advance the peace and happiness and prosperity of the United States. Indeed, they are absolutely challenging the status quo all around the world, and it's having very serious consequences for the American people. So when we look out at the world, you know, obviously we have our core allies and partners, first among them, Australia and Japan and others like that. But then we also have civilizational partners. You know, Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee talked about how the United States and India are natural allies. And what he meant by that is that essentially we think the same way, we look out at the world the same way, we have the same values, we have the same apprehensions. And the great thing about Indians, all 1.4 billion of them, is that they're passionately devoted to democracy and they're passionately devoted to human freedom, which makes them very good natural friends of the United States. So if India goes from being a $4 trillion economy today to a $5 or $8 or $10 trillion economy in the next few years, to even becoming a $30 trillion economy by the mid-century, which it has every potential to do, growing at 8% right now, those people of India, even as they become more prosperous, are going to continue to remain natural allies and friends of the American people. And they're going to espouse essentially the software that we're familiar with, the software of freedom of expression, freedom of inquiry, freedom of assembly, freedom of thought and intellect and research. And ultimately, they will stand up for the freedom and sovereignty of nations, not only their own and ours, but many others around the world. So I'm boundlessly optimistic that the rise of India in world affairs is going to be a net benefit for the American people.
So Atul, you talked a lot about India's commitment to freedom. Of course, India just had a big election, which was, at least in the Western press, cast as something of a rebuke to the current Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, and a bit of a vote against authoritarianism, at least, again, as the Western press has cast it. Is that how you read it?
Well, first and foremost, let's keep in mind that this is, you know, yet again, the Indian people voting with their feet, literally, in support of their democracy. If you look at the numbers are just awe-inspiring. Over 970 million eligible voters. I think 642 million people actually voted in the election. The election was spread over seven different stages because it's such a vast enterprise. And there were over 1.2 million polling stations, something like 15 million volunteers. I say that it's the single largest exercise of the franchise, democratic franchise, by people anywhere ever in the history of humanity. So it's a victory for the Indian people. It's a victory for democracy. It's a victory for the notion of government by the people, for the people, and of the people. And so it is an achievement of which every American and every free person around the world should feel very proud. And frankly, the Indian voter puts paid to the nonsense that only rich or developed societies can afford to have democracy. India has been progressing mightily in its own way, in its very democratic way, which is also a counterpoint to claims that people in Asia can't have growth and democracy at the same time, have growth and human freedom. You know, India is humming along at 8%. So when you look at the results, it's pretty clear that the Indian people voted first and foremost to show the entire world their passionate commitment to democracy, but they also showed that they not only appreciate the work of the BJP in growing the economy, but that they want to have a little more balance in how it's all done. I think, you know, one sense, and I'm not an expert necessarily, but one sense is that the Indian voters wanted to call attention to the need for greater economic development in the rural areas. That's one of the early indications we're seeing. And so there's every expectation that the Indian government is going to focus even more on jobs, jobs, jobs. And we can talk more about that. And, you know, they did return Prime Minister Modi to office for the third time, albeit with a coalition. This is the first time since Jawaharlal Nehru back in 1962 that a Prime Minister of India has had three successive terms in office. It's a historic achievement by the Prime Minister. So there can be a lot of lessons derived from it. You know, the Western media has a perspective. I think Indians have a perspective. But for me, number one, the absolute victory is that of democracy and the notion that a nation can grow through citizen-driven democracy.
So the economic growth of the past few years have been very impressive under Prime Minister Modi. But there's been a lot of criticism over the years that India hasn't attracted its share of foreign direct investment. Due to economic nationalism, a very difficult sclerotic bureaucracy, and just ease of doing business, it's mid-ranking on the World Bank Index. So when you talk to American companies interested in investing in India, well, how do you advise them?
So I think there's a lot of validity, Jim, to what you just said. You know, India has gone from the rock bottom of the World Bank's ease of doing index to probably in the something like the 50s or 60s. The government of India has put a lot of effort into trying to improve the ease and speed of doing business in India. But as I say to them as a friend, they have competition. They have competition in Indonesia, in Ohio, in Vietnam, in Mexico. And so they've got to keep at it if they want to attract more FDI that will generate more jobs. So what I tell them is that the more they can work on the ease and speed of doing business, the more they can work on, you know, swift arbitration of disputes, ensuring a level playing field for foreign companies that are investing in India. And of course, you know, just smoothing out the regulatory and tax and procedural hurdles, the more that companies will come to them. And what I tell foreign companies, especially American companies, is if you don't have an India play, you're not recognizing the realities of growth over the next 30, 40 years on our planet. You know, India today is a $4 trillion economy. India in 10 years could be a $15 trillion economy. And so you've got to have an India play considering there's 1.4 billion Indian citizens. It's a giant market. And Indians are becoming increasingly prosperous, right? Further, there is more scalable, available, skilled human talent for, you know, the hardcore engineering and science jobs, computer science jobs in India than in any other place on earth, bar none. And companies know this because India generates computer sciences and engineering and science graduates in numbers that are just greatly in excess of any other country on earth. So companies need to have an India strategy. They need to understand that India is extremely complex. It's, in fact, probably the most complex country on earth. And that everything you do with India has to be bespoke and has to be cognizant of the conditions in India. And I think companies that are smart and do their homework and do their due diligence can succeed very well in India, but they have to have a certain kind of fixedness of purpose to get through what is still a pretty complicated situation.
So you talked about jobs, 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 and you also hinted at an urban-rural divide. It sounds like there is an issue with, you know, trying to create more jobs, but also an issue with the fact that these jobs are probably going to exist, you know, primarily in the cities, which sounds like it would exacerbate that divide. Since you sounded like you wanted to talk more about jobs, let's talk about jobs.
Sure, Ray. So one thing that struck me a long time ago when I was serving in India in the U.S. Embassy, this is 2005, 2008, was that 60% of the Indian workforce and indeed demographic lives in the rural sector, in the rural economy. But that rural economy only generates about 20 to 22% of Indian GDP. And it hasn't grown much. It's been kind of stagnant over the past 20 years. Whereas the services economy has just been soaring. I mean, India is a services superpower. So I think the government's challenge is, how do you create the tens, if not hundreds of millions of jobs to help people transition into more productive means of employment and largely transition out of the rural economy into the manufacturing economy? There's already great movement into the Indian cities. And indeed, if you look at the scale and sweep of development in India, it is clear that the government and the various states are intensively investing to build the India of tomorrow. And if you look at the roads and the highways and the airports and the metros and the things you need for human life, hospitals, schools, etc., the amount of development that is happening is mind-boggling. It's like China in a certain era, or maybe the U.S. in the era of the Eisenhower interstate system. But they still need to keep building all of that because they're anticipating that movement into the cities. There's going to be a more urban India than there is today. There is a broad realization that there has to be some form of reform of the agricultural sector to modernize it, to make it more competitive, and to bring in new technologies. And American companies are the absolute leaders in those technologies to enhance farm yields. But then it's a very complicated political matter to work on getting people toward manufacturing from the rural economy. So you have to have jobs in order to attract people out of the rural economy into them. And this is where I think the focus has to be on FDI. There's been an amazingly focused effort by the government of India to get FDI into semiconductors. If you looked at the joint statement between Prime Minister Modi and President Biden last June, there were three U.S. IBC companies that were mentioned in that joint statement as doing increased semiconductor investment in India: Micron, Western Digital, and Lam Research. And then you've also got the success with Apple, where the government of India has been really focused on helping Apple build and export iPhones from India. And so there's been a clear amount of focus in that. But on semiconductors, there aren't a lot of jobs involved in fabs. There's a few bit jobs in packaging and testing, but not many in fabs. Of course, in manufacturing iPhones, there are a lot of jobs. But they're going to have to really expand employment in job-creating manufacturing areas. And this is where the government, just in the last 3-4 days since the ministers got sworn in, announced a doubling of what are called production-linked incentives, PLIs, for companies around the world to invest in India in electronics manufacturing. They recognize they have an opportunity. Their wages are competitive compared to China. Their logistics are not yet competitive. What I was told is that despite all of the enormous investments by India into logistics, China is about 8 cents and India is about 14 cents in terms of logistics. So it's a structural issue that the government of India is working on. Prime Minister has this Gati Shakti efficiency drive for logistics, but they're throwing money, government money, at the production-linked incentives in order to shrink that delta, in order to bring in FDI, in order to boost manufacturing and create that, large mass of jobs that are needed, one, because people need jobs, and two, because they want to transition out of the farming economy.
So you talked a lot about high tech as what India is looking to attract, but India also has what should be one of the largest consumer markets in the world. I remember when American companies were falling over themselves to get access to the Chinese market, but they don't seem to be working as hard in the Indian market. Is it too difficult, or are they not focused, or what?
So, you know, there are many Indias, right? There's rural India of, you know, probably, gosh, you know, at least 500-600 million people, if not more. And they're at a certain, you know, socioeconomic level. And then there's sort of aspiring urban India, where you've got people who are at another socioeconomic level. And then within urban India, you've got middle-class Indians, folks who live, you know, standards of living roughly approximate to ours. And then you have super rich India, very elite India. This is the Mumbai of the billionaires, you know, hundreds of billionaires in Mumbai. All of those Indias exist together. I think American companies have actually been in India for so long that people forget that they are American. You know, look at, some of the companies that have been there since 1901, General Electric, Abbott, 1920, Procter & Gamble, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, you know, you name the American company, they've been there for a very long time. And so they actually have developed consumer networks in India. And then you look at the more recent digital companies like Amazon, Walmart, who have also come in and have enormous presences and activities in India. So I think that, you know, maybe that old heady rhetoric of selling one toothbrush to a billion people in China kind of fell off because it didn't work in China. I think a lot of people were disappointed that they never really got into the Chinese market. And when they did, their IP and their products were copied and outcompeted by local competitors. I think it's a little more nuanced in India. You've got companies that have been there a long time. You've got new entrants that are doing really well. And of course, the Indian market is competitive. Some say it's protectionist, and there have been some indications of that in the past. But generally speaking, companies can get in. They can market and sell in India, but they have to do their homework. They can't take a one-size-fits-all approach that a product sold elsewhere in the world will work in India. Everything is about bespoke approaches in India, bespoke in terms of what you sell, bespoke in how you sell it and market it, bespoke in how you distribute it, bespoke in how you manage your factories and your distribution and your, you know, whatever else you do. Like, if you don't localize to India, there's a lot of examples of companies that have not done well.
Is it India as a whole country, or each state also has to be localized for?
So states are, there's like 28 major states, and the states also are very, very, very localized. So what works in state X may not work in state Y, right? It is increasingly a national market thanks to a major innovation in the GST tax that is nationwide and an end to the old octroi system, which existed back into the Mughal Empire. So India, for the first time, is largely a national market. And this is just in the last 10 years of Prime Minister Modi's term in office. So it's a lot easier to move goods around the country and have kind of a national approach, but you have to have state-to-state marketing because, you know, the language in one state will be totally different from the language in another state. So, you know, India ain't easy. It's not for amateurs. It takes a lot of complexity if you want to survive and succeed.
So Atul, you brought up China, and so I want to turn a little bit to geopolitics. And I want to start with, at a high level, can you explain what is the line of actual control and why do we see videos of people throwing rocks and beating each other over the heads with clubs up there?
So it's really interesting. If you look at how India has managed its relations with its neighbors, even where there are territorial disputes, with Bangladesh, India and Bangladesh have had a very courteous and mutually respectful process of sorting out the absolute mess that the British left behind when they drew the partition lines, which were so devastating for human beings on both sides. And there's been all these successive and successful boundary discussions between India and Bangladesh to solve problems in a friendly and neighborly way. If you look at the maritime disputes between India, Myanmar, and Bangladesh over their rather messy shared maritime boundaries, all three nations went for binding peaceful arbitration. The arbitral panel met, it set out the lines, all three countries accepted it, and they went on with their lives. And now all three countries, each in their own zone, is able to exploit the fisheries and mineral rights of those areas. This is true of India's relations with Bhutan, with India's relations with Nepal. There are issues, Sri Lanka, there are issues, but they are worked in a kind of a, you know, a attitude of mutual respect. I would note, and you guys know this as better as well as anyone, that China has very hot and tendentious territorial and maritime disputes with Japan, with Korea, with Taiwan, with Vietnam, with Philippines, with India, and with just about every country in its periphery. And you remember back in the early 60s when China and Russia almost went to nuclear war over their territorial disputes. So the Indians live in a very tough neighborhood, right? You've got nuclear-armed China to your north. You've got nuclear-armed Pakistan to the west. These lines were drawn, you know, in an earlier era. When the British drew these lines, Tibet was a buffer country, and it created a lot of distance between the Han civilization and the Indian civilization. Tibet is no longer a buffer country, and so these two great powers abut one another. And, you know, there's been, gosh, I don't know, probably more than a dozen, if not two dozen rounds of border talks between India and China about the very long border across two zones where they have so many different disputes. And the Chinese are still sitting on Aksai Chin as an annexure from what was India. And so I don't see this resolving anytime soon. It's interesting to me that both countries have agreed that border disputes will be fought with fists and sticks and stones. That's really interesting that when you have two nuclear armed neighbors who have such a tough history, including a war back in 1962, an ongoing struggle with each other, that they have by mutual consent agreed that that's how they will, you know, solve or deal with frustrations at the border. I think it's clear that the Indians have a spirit of wanting to resolve their border issues and doing so even with powers that are smaller than them. But with the Chinese, they are also equally determined not to give an inch. And I think they look to the United States as a friend and a partner. Lord knows, when I last worked in government, when Galwan happened, the United States of America rushed everything it could to be helpful to India, because that's what friends do. And I think we feel that the Indians are hard done by the Chinese in this, just like the Philippines feels and Japan feels and Taiwan feels and Vietnam feels, and we could just keep going on and on about Chinese territory disputes. And I'd leave one last line on this, Ray. If the People's Republic of China could resolve its issues in the South China Sea the way India did in the Bay of Bengal with binding peaceful arbitration, we wouldn't have the strategic tensions and challenges we all face right now.
Well, the Philippines tried, and we're informed by the Chinese international law doesn't apply to them, which is.
I was going to say, if pigs had feathers, they'd be birds.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting. India, of course, a founder and leader of the Non-Aligned Movement during the Cold War, still has a sense of it being the leader of the Global South, or at least a leader of the Global South, and yet it's joined in with the so-called Quad, grouping with Australia, Japan, the U.S., in some sort of agreement to work together, especially in Southeast Asia. How does India view the Quad? What does India hope to get out of that?
So I don't think it would be inappropriate to say that for India and America, and maybe for the Australians as well, that really what we're all just doing is essentially following Prime Minister Abe Shinzo's vision, right? If you think about his speech about the democratic diamond and how the great democracies of the Indo-Pacific had to get together to ensure that every country in the Indo-Pacific could be free and open, the free and open Indo-Pacific, and that every country could be sovereign, I think the Indians readily agree with that, as do we, and as have we for the past 15, 20 years. In a way, you know, the Quad is Shinzo Abe's world, and we're just living in it. And we're living in it because it makes sense, because we have seen collectively, whether it's in the Solomon Islands, or it's in Sri Lanka, where I've seen with my own eyes, or it's in Malaysia, or in countries in the Indian Ocean or the Pacific, or in Africa, or on the Indian subcontinent itself, a sustained effort by outside powers to try to erode the sovereignty and happiness and freedom of lots of little countries, that in a way that is deleterious to them and to their happiness and their people's happiness, but also to the strategic stability of the Indo-Pacific. And so when you see all of this happening, I think if you're Tokyo and Delhi and Washington and Canberra, all of a sudden you want to do something about it. And you don't, this is not an aggressive play. This is not at all an aggressive play. It's a defensive play to try to preserve and uphold a free and open Indo-Pacific. And so I think over the many years that we collectively, you and me, Jim, Ray as well, and all worked on this, the conversations began with an exchange of views about the problem set and an apprehension that the trend lines were not going well, and then a great readiness to accept that the other guy may also share our views, and that therefore we may have a basis for shared effort, and that therefore we ought to have a program of work. And if you look at the things the Quad has worked on, maritime domain awareness, vaccinations, disaster relief, infrastructure, this is again about making sure that countries remain free and that they don't become suborned to a hostile outside threat that may wish to make them more like, countries over which someone else has a certain sovereignty and suzerainty.
Well, one place that the U.S. and India are not well aligned is on Russia. And in fact, we just had a big peace conference up in there with the Swiss organized it. And India, it was one of the countries that declined to sign the joint statement that was issued. What is it about Russia? What's that?
You didn't mention it's about Ukraine.
Yes, about Ukraine. So what is it about Russia that causes India to go in a different direction than the United States?
So this is, I think, an area where Indians ought to do their own, sort of analysis. So I, as an outsider and an American, I can offer my two cents, but it's really only that. What I have heard from Indians is that they are quite apprehensive about the notion that the entire sweep of Asia above them over the Himalayas from Vladivostok all the way to St. Petersburg may become essentially in some way or another suborned to Beijing and to the People's Republic of China. It worries them very greatly. India has a very long and very different history with Russia than we do. They were friends with the Russians during the Cold War, and indeed the Russians were great friends to them during the Cold War, including at times when they felt like we, the United States, were being extremely hostile to them and inimical to their strategic necessities. And the Indians remind me, they say, we don't view Russia the same way you people do. We don't have the hangups you have with them. Indeed, we have always viewed them as our very reliable and trusted partner. They say this to me very clearly. And they remind me of all of the instances in history, 1971 being most prominent, where the Russians stood with them against us, in ways that were beneficial to India. The Indians have not forgotten. The Indians also rely on Russia for some absolutely crucial things that they do, including a very essential element of national security, especially when you face two hostile nuclear armed enemies, and that is survivable nuclear triad, particularly submarine launched ballistic missiles, a critical component of national security for a nuclear power. And if you look at all of the areas where the Russians are critical to India, these are all areas where we as Americans decided not to play for law or policy or regulation. One is SLBM technology, where the Indians came to us, I think about 20 years ago, and said, hey, we'd rather learn the nuclear navy from you. But we said, we're not going to play, ballistic missile defense, where the Indians came to us and said, hey, we'd like to buy from you. And we said, nope, we're not going to play. And so they went with the Russians. Rocket technology for outer space, where for a lot of sanctions related to our previous relationship in an earlier era with India, we decided not to play. And there may be other areas as well, fighter planes, where, you know, the Russians sell them the plane and that's their plane and they can use it any way they want. So the Indians have had this out with me because I've talked to them in private about it. And they've said, look, our relationship is quantitatively and qualitatively different. We also have to worry about the strategic implications of an Asia above us across the Himalayas that is essentially dancing to Beijing's beat. We cannot afford that. And we have to preserve the sovereignty and independence of Russia. And you just have to understand that.
Let me have a quick follow-up there, because, of course, we now in the United States have legislation on the books that sanctions Russian sales of military equipment, the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, or CATSA. How has India, with its large stock of Russian inventory, how have they reacted and responded to CATSA?
You'd have to ask the Indians. And, you know, they do have a very large stock of Russian hardware. And that's another reason why they feel that they have to ensure the independence of Russia in order to ensure the, you know, continued supply chain for that stuff to be available to them, right? If you look at all their frontline fighters and so much else besides. I think what's going on is that there's a productive discussion going on between the U.S. and India about India's future defense needs, right? If you look at the way the battle space is changing, you know, the Ukraine war and before that, the Armenia-Azerbaijan war have taught us that there is a very rapid pace of change happening in warfare. And I'm not a warfare expert, but you just look at drones alone and you realize there's a whole new world out there. We've got to figure out what a totally different 21st century way of fighting war looks like and what kinds of platforms and what kinds of technology and what kinds of innovation will help countries prevail in this very new world that we're dealing with. You saw Admiral Paparo talking about what they would do in the Taiwan Strait in the case of a very hostile situation and the kinds of technologies that the U.S. Air Force and Navy and others would use. I think the Indians are thinking about that as well. And they recognize that our technology leads the world in many ways. And I think we, when I say we, I mean, my former employer, the U.S. government, is looking at how we can increase and enhance the defense cooperation with India to help India be better positioned to ensure deterrence. Deterrence is the greatest way to avoid a war. You know, if your adversary thinks you're a prickly hedgehog, he'll leave you alone. And so having the great democracies work together to ensure mutual deterrence is very, very important. And this is where, over the past few years, and you mentioned CATSA, I think the U.S. and India have realized that they should focus more on their areas of cooperation than on accentuating their differences, because accentuating the differences, frankly, doesn't help either of us. And, you know, I don't speak for the U.S. government. They can speak for themselves. I'm a pensioner and a retiree, but I would much rather have the United States government and the Indian government work on the collaborative plan of future defense work together than do other things that would drive us apart. And so you look at the MQ-9 drones, you look at the GE-414 engines. Now there's talk about Strykers, you know, those APCs, I think they're called. There's a lot that we can do together, especially, I think, in drone warfare, which is really the wave of the future, to enhance our convergence and not focus merely on our differences.
So the other U.S. adversary that India seems to have a pretty good relationship with is Iran, and imports a lot of Iranian oil and gas. And it's interesting that the BJP, which is a Hindu nationalist party, is close to a militant Islamic theocracy. Could you explain that relationship to us?
So this is where I think the Indians are very pragmatic, right? They look at every relationship around them from an extremely pragmatic lens. So if even with Red China, where they have enormous problems and border disputes, and they, you know, I think acknowledge that the Chinese are potentially their existential threat, certainly under communism, They will engage with the Chinese on trade issues. China is a very large trading partner of India. They will engage with the Chinese on the boundary dispute, but they are very wary. And if you look at their investment regime and how it kind of, you know, is very suspicious of Chinese investment, you can see that. It's kind of a two-speed approach. But then they also really work well with their friends, and they have many friends, Japan, the United States, France, Israel, all good friends of India, all working very well with India in many, many domains of human achievement, Australia as well, great friend of India. Then you look at countries like Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi, where the Indians feel a great deal of affection because you've got 7 million Indians living in the Arabian Gulf, and they want to make sure those folks are protected and safe. And so they have rock-solid relations with Riyadh and with Abu Dhabi. But then they also have good relations with Qatar because they import a lot of natural gas from Qatar. They have good relations with Dubai because so many Indians live in Dubai. And they maintain useful relations with Tehran, because they see Tehran, or rather Iran, as essential strategic geography because it is behind Pakistan. And it also provides potentially a pathway for India toward Central Asia and Europe, a terrestrial pathway, a land-based pathway toward Central Asia and Europe. Because when the British drew the borders with the Wakhan Corridor and the northern territories of Gilgit and Baltistan, and there's history that's been written about it, the British intention was to cleave off India from Russia, to separate it as part of the ongoing great game that had been going on since the 1830s, to sort of keep the British influence over India as far from Tsarist Russia as humanly possible. When they drew the borders in 1947, it was with that intent that they would enshrine a physical separation between the Soviet Union, which at that point was in Tajikistan, and India, which was just across in Gilgit, Baltistan, and the Northern Territories. So the Indians for 75 years have been trying to overcome that gap in order to have an ability to trade with Europe directly over a land route and to trade with Russia directly over a land route. And in the absence of that, because of the geography of Pakistan and the setbacks of 1947 and 48 in the northern territories of Jammu and Kashmir, they view the Chabahar port in Iranian Balochistan and the potential connectivity from Chabahar into Russia and Central Asia as absolutely critical for undoing their geographic encirclement. So they are working on the India-Middle East corridor, which is from the ports in Western India to the ports of the United Arab Emirates to the rail line that's going to cross Saudi Arabia and into Israel, and then from ports in Israel all the way into Europe as one method of overcoming this legacy historical geographical encirclement. And the other is Chabahar. So Indian foreign policy, you know, back to the era of Brijesh Mishra, is one of self-avowed promiscuity, that they will figure out where the advantage lies in every different relationship, and they will seek that advantage because they want to see India rise in world affairs to be strong and prosperous and capable and independent. And they will, you know, like the honeybee goes from flower to flower, they will go to any flower where they think they can get something useful for the Indian people. And it's not a it's not an ideological foreign policy. It's a policy of pragmatism rooted in the desire to see India rise up the league's tables to be in the front ranks of nations. So that's a very long answer to a short question, but I hope it gives some insight into why the Indians continue to engage with Iran. Lord knows they've heard it from us. I mean, yeah, they've heard it from us.
I will just add
one more thing, Jim, before I pass it back to you. There's also about 4,000 years of relations between Indian civilization and Iranian civilization. You know, if you look at like even the words of Persian and the words of Sanskrit and Hindustani are often the same. So they also remind that, you know, when you've been together for 4,000 years, you kind of have to keep that up. I'll stop there.
Well, the Mughals came from there, right? And that's part of the tension now.
From, The Mughals came from Central Asia, not from Persia.
So
one honeybee that has been going from flower to flower is Narendra Modi himself. And when he travels, he inspires quite the response from people that in the countries he travels to. And I'll get you out of here on this exit question. We've often referred to these as Howdy Modi events, and they are quite the spectacle. What explains those? Why are they such a spectacle?
I have my personal perspective. I went to the very first of these events, which was at Madison Square Garden back in, I want to say like May or June of 2014. And I was in the garden as a U.S. government official invited to witness this. But there must have been 30,000 Indian Americans just screaming their lungs out about the Prime Minister of India. And it was more rock concert than political speech. A couple things struck me. Number one, he has a direct connect with the audience. Number two, he's an incredible speaker. Incredible. I mean, like natural born orator. Number three, he places the historical context into his remarks. Everywhere I've seen him speak or read the transcript or watched the video, Australia, Belgium, Egypt, America, Britain, Canada, everywhere he goes, he mentions the historical context and what it means for Indians, what it means for Indian civilization, what it means for Indian people. One particular thing I find really endearing as a student of history is that he honors the Indian fighting servicemen everywhere he goes. And so, you know, there are Commonwealth graves to Indian servicemen all around Europe and the Middle East and Far East Asia and Africa. Everywhere he goes, he honors those people, because in the 100 years since World War I, the Indian fighting man and woman helped uphold human freedom, World War I, World War II, and he never forgets it. Previous governments of India may have overlooked it, but not this one, not this government, not this prime minister. And he also very clearly connects to the diaspora and revels in their experience as having helped build the prosperity and happiness of South Africa, Zambia, Kenya, America. You know, he talks about the Sardarji emigrants from India who came to California in the 1880s and 1890s. He reminds people of that history, and he does it in such a charismatic way, with such a power of delivery, that people are inspired. I mean, I've seen tens of thousands of people just as crazy as you'll ever see them because of a politician, which I think most politicians around the world would envy him for that ability. So it's a natural talent, but it's a natural talent that is also reflective of an enormous amount of research. I read the speech he gave to the Sri Lankan parliament. I was U.S. ambassador to Sri Lanka. It was astounding how he wove together in that speech over 2,500 years of India-Sri Lanka history and shared ups and downs and tragedies to remind them that they are the closest of neighbors and they have an immensely long history together, and that therefore they have to work with each other to overcome their problems and help their people. It was an amazing piece of statecraft. And I think that's what explains that genuine affection that world leaders have for him, because they're frankly trying to catch a little bit of whatever he's got.
Well, Atul Kashyap, the president of the U.S.-India Business Council, we can see why you're such an effective president. You have an incredibly optimistic and upbeat view on this relationship. So we thank you for joining us, and we hope to have you back.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you, Jim. Great to see both of you. Thank you very much for inviting me and having me.
Ray, if we didn't think Asia as a whole isn't complex enough, India is its whole universe in itself, with so many contradictions and issues which I can't begin to understand or get to the bottom of.
Well, I really appreciated that that interview, because I honestly, I know far too little about India. And so he was able to give us kind of a very broad view, very high level view of a lot of things. And it was very careful about explaining them in simple terms. So I really appreciated that.
Yeah, it was very useful. But there's so many other areas we could have gone down.
One thing really
to mind is if India is sort of this transactional, pragmatic foreign policy entity, if we have a President Trump who is nothing if not transactional, what's that going to look like?
Yeah. Well, I hopefully we'll get this out of a future guest, but I had the Maldives on my list as well. Of course, the country off to its southwestern coast, the island country that just took a hard turn away from India and toward China.
Right. No, India is a foreign policy power in the region for sure. It has its own gravitational pull.
Yeah. So, you know, of course, India just passed China as the world's most populous country. And, you know, I think probably we are still to some degree sleeping on its potential as a powerhouse. But as we started off and as our entry question states, you know, they're planning to be the world's third largest economy behind the U.S. and China very, very soon. And, you know, I think to a great extent, much of the world is still not paying much attention.
Well, you know, they don't have the global brands that other countries have. They have Infosys in the computer space, Tata Industries, which I guess some people know is a big industrial powerhouse, but consumer brands you just never see. And what's also interesting is you think of all the incredibly talented Indian folks who came here to work and are in our infotech space and run truck stops, everything. They're a highly entrepreneurial folks who come here, and yet we don't see this global entity that you think of as India.
Yeah. Well, I myself only took my first trip to India late last year. It was a heck of an education for me, especially from a guy whose education in India had been essentially, you know, watching Gandhi Once Upon a Time or Slumdog Millionaire in recent times. So I was happy to find, you know, a very, you know, sort of thriving country that I felt very safe walking around in. And actually, you know, of course, you know, India is, besides being the world's most populous country, is now the world's largest, or has for many years been the world's largest English speaking country.
That's right. And democracy. Let's not forget.
And democracy. Yeah.
Actually, I'll pitch a book, which I don't normally do, but there's a book by James Crabtree, who's a Financial Times writer, called The Billionaire Raj, which talks a lot about this incredible economic growth and then focuses on some of the individuals who've really made it big, who are some of the richest people in the world. But again, the complexity and the opportunity is just remarkable.
Well, I think that brings us, Jim, to our story time, and it is your turn. So it is There I Was. So, sir, where were you?
Okay, since we're talking about business opportunity and why sometimes it manifests into success and sometimes it doesn't. So I was the sole economic and commercial officer at our U.S. Embassy in Nicosia, Cyprus. And as you may know, Cyprus is divided into two as a result of the 1974 Turkish invasion, which resulted in a de facto northern Cyprus and the world-recognized southern Cyprus run by Greek Cypriots. And so one of the things I tried to do was bring the business communities together in the hope that eventually they would help towards reunification of the island, which is the overall goal. So I was working with some American companies there, trying to get them to talk to both sides and bring some Cypriots together to meet with them. And what struck me so much is, as we explained the opportunities to both sides, there were probably a significant minority of the business people who said, you know what? This looks like a great opportunity, but I'd rather not get advantage of that opportunity if it means that other guy is going to succeed. So a lose-lose was better than a win-win. And boy, that really struck my capitalist heart to the core.
Well, you know, fortunately here in the United States, we don't have those kinds of political divisions. We just want everybody to be equally successful, or I hope so.
God, you're so happy there in California.
All right, Jim, this has been a blast. Really enjoyed this one. And again, I want to give another shout out here to our producer, Ian Ellis-Jones. I just was at a function last night where one of my colleagues was raving about the production of this podcast series and asking me, who's your producer? who's your producer? So our producer is Ian Ellis-Jones, up where you are in New York, Jim, and he does a fantastic job for us. And he's also very worth a follow on Twitter or X, at Ian Ellis-Jones. He does great work on graphics for geopolitical events, gets a lot of attention from a lot of very important people when things happen, because he's able to make things so very clear. So shout out to Ian, and for Ian and Jim, this is Ray. Thanks for this edition of Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?